The Columbus Dispatch is sharing the stories of Black people in the Columbus area who have experienced racism in a series called Blackout. I'm Dispatch reporter Erica Thompson, and in this podcast episode, you will hear from Tom Dillard, a native of the Near East Side who spent years working in the community and held leadership positions with the Impact Community Action Organization and the Model Cities Program. Dillard talks about the prejudice he witnessed in education, employment, housing, and other areas of life. To read the stories in our Blackout series, visit dispatch.com.
Well, I want to thank you again for joining me to discuss this very important subject.
Okay.
And so I know you live on the Northeast Side now, but you spent many decades on the Near East Side where African Americans thrived and experienced so many changes as a result of government policy and other disruptive efforts. But I thought we could begin by you telling everyone about your career and your work in the community.
I was born and raised, on the East Side, lived on Clifton and Taylor. People from the East Side know that location. Grew up there, then raised my family on Hawthorne Park and Woodland. And I've gone to Eastgate, Franklin East, and got to play football at Muskingum College and got a master's degree in social work from Case Western Reserve. My whole family's been active in the community over years with Constance Nichols and people at CORE and the Vanguard League. So I was raised in that environment and had an opportunity to interact with a lot of the, grassroots leaders, when they were all grassroots leaders before they came big time politicians, but to work with those folks during those days. And so I'm a witness. I'm not just a participant, but a witness to some of the things that were happening in Columbus, pretty much, Erica, during the time period of the 40s through the 90s, that kind of 50-year period.
Yeah, thank you. You did mention Constance Nichols, your aunt, and I think it's so important for Columbus Black history to be preserved and shared. So can you just tell us briefly about who Constance Nichols was and what she contributed?
Okay, Constance Nichols, we called her Aunt Jean, was a member of a group called the Vanguard League, which in the 40s challenged some of the discrimination practices here in Columbus, primarily at the movie theaters that still exist, Ohio Theater and the Palace, and also restaurants in town and swimming pools. So it included Bobby Dorham, Judge Brooks, and other folks who really put themselves on the line to protest against those situations, pretty much back in the 40s and the like. And that's where, you know, the swimming pools then were segregated, so she worked on that. So she was quite an active person. A lot of her stuff of the Vanguard League is filed at the Ohio Historical Center. And I need to add this. It's not just my aunt, Constance Nichols, but there were other women. If you look at this community, Black women have been a leading force in this community against segregation. And we kind of overlooked that because of the sexist times back in the 40s. But I can name them from Otto Beatty's grandmother, and then a lot of folks really were stand-up people with respect to desegregation back then.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that. So as you mentioned, I mean, you were a witness to so many different methods of prejudice and systemic racism here in Columbus. And you do have a million stories, which is sad to think about, but it is also helpful for people who are trying to better understand everything that has happened to the Black community and what the community has had to endure. So I would like to open it up to you to share some of those stories. I know you've talked about Taylor Avenue being the dividing line between between the white neighborhood and black neighborhood on the east side. So if you could maybe start there and then talk about what you saw in terms of how the neighborhood changed and white folks moving out, black folks moving in, and all of that.
It was the most interesting transition. Taylor Avenue was the dividing line between the white community and the black community. This is pretty much 40s, 50s kind of time frame. There was a house on Menlo Avenue right on the corner. It's still there. It was for sale, and a gentleman by the name of Tom Colston and his family still around wanted to buy the house. And it was on the other side of Taylor Avenue, on the white side of Taylor Avenue. Yeah. So he went to the banks to get a loan. He was an accountant and worked down in Dayton at the air base in Dayton. Had a degree, all that kind of stuff, and the banks wouldn't loan him money. And he finally met a guy named Stanley Robinson, who was a Quaker, white fella, lived up in Worthington. And Stanley took him up to a bank in Sunbury that loaned him the money. Mm-hmm. So he was one of the first folks that moved on the other side of Taylor. From that point on, as I can remember, a lot of white folks moved out of the neighborhood. And one of my most favorite stories was when the little boy next door, who was the son of the pastor at Asbury Church, came in and told my mother and said to my mother, Mrs. Dillard, we're moving. And Mom said, well, why are you moving? And he said, because the are moving in. Mm. Is what she Mom never told me what she said back. But that's the kind of conversation. But let me tell you something about that. As that change happened, Clifton Avenue, Richmond Avenue, Granville Street, Menlo Place became the most amazing place. On one corner, you had a millionaire doctor. Next to him was a mother with four kids on assistance. It was amazing. The first black policeman, one of the first black sheriff's deputies, we called him Rooster Good, lived down the street, across the street from a guy named that owned the Jamaica Breeze that brought Ike and Tina Turner to town, owned a bar up on Mount Vernon. So it was really a real diverse in terms of interests and backgrounds on that street and in that community. From there, let me tell you that what happened was Truman signed the bill that integrated the defense contractors. And so for the first time, black folks had an opportunity to work at DCSC, work at Curtis Wright, and some of the other contractors. And as a result of that, were able to earn a salary that allowed them to buy a house in Eastgate, and even more important, to send their kids to college.
You know, speaking of college, I would like for you to talk a little bit about your mother, because she went to school to become a teacher. Can you talk about some of the challenges that she faced after graduation?
Well, let me start at her going to college. She, along with a group of just amazing people, including Jesse Owens, in 1932, went to the Ohio State University. She and her colleagues, African-American colleagues, could not live on campus, including Jesse Owens. So they had to live in the community. Now, here's the beautiful piece. Many of them ended up having jobs as maids or whatever for white folks in Bexley in the evening, but in the day were able to go to the Ohio State University to school. And many of them graduated with honors. Once they graduated, many of them couldn't find jobs. My mother got a degree as a teacher, and I think her major was education and her minor was French. But she couldn't find a job with Columbus Public Schools because there were only certain schools that black people could work at. Champion was one. Pilgrim was the other. East High School. And maybe I think Summit Linden, but that was pretty restricted in terms of who could find jobs.
I also want to talk about the construction of the highway and that the impact on the Near East Side. We have a more extensive story about that in our Blackout series, but I'd like to hear your personal experience, what you remember about that, the construction of the highway and the impact on the community.
I know. Time period, 60s, 70s, I think I was working for Model Cities then. They came to us and said, we're going to build a freeway that cuts off Mount Vernon to downtown. At that point, Mount Vernon was a thriving commercial community, and the anticipation of having that extend downtown, which was at Aquinas, where Aquinas High School sat on Cleveland Avenue, what was exciting. People were looking forward to that. Matter of fact, there's some small businesses there. But the powers that be came to the powers that be, then the African-American community, get permission, and did. And it cut it off, and it went through some streets and neighborhoods, Buckingham, Washington Avenue, of course, cut off Mount Vernon. And those were, how do I say, those were the homes of people who have come here, who migrated here from the South, part of the Great Migration, and worked at Buckeye Steel and Malleable Castings and the other steel factories, and bought homes there. And so those families, and there were some famous people that lived on that in that neighborhood that got cut off of Buckingham. And those people then moved to a place called Flytown, which is now Italian Village, and up on the hilltop. But what it did, it really isolated the African-American community. Mount Vernon and Long Street was a lifeline to access the resources downtown and to expand their businesses. And now that was taken away. And so the African-American businesses, et cetera, did not have a way to move downtown or to expand their business to new communities. Let me add this. Jerry Hammond and Ako Kanbaum, when they got into office, one of the things they had as a number one priority was to build access to the African-American community and get off that freeway. Now we have that spur that you can get off on. And Jerry and Ako pushed that so we could have access again. But that really hasn't had a devastating effect. But in addition to that, integration also had an effect on it too, because as people integrated, African-American business had a harder time to compete with some of the bigger stores, et cetera, and the like.
Yeah.
Did that kind of give you a feel for what it is and where the folks went, based on my understanding? And I'm just one old man.
So. Yes, sir. Yes. It's not. You know, I'm kind of curious, how do you feel or what do you think about when you reflect on all of these stories? And you've just given us a small sample because I know you have other stories. So is it difficult to look back on these? Have you been thinking about these stories more and more because of what we're seeing now with the most recent Black Lives Matter protest?
When I think back, at first I weep for the hell that people come. It wasn't right. But then again, I take pride because I know the folks and stood and fought against it. And I so admire them. And I so admire the fact that when I was coming up, I would listen to what they would say. The wisdom of MJ Mitchell, of Amos Lynch, of Bill Toler, of I could just name hundreds of people that I listened to, and they told me of their character. And it's that sense of character, that sense of love for community, the sense of protecting our folks, still rises with me today. And every time I get an occasion, I end up preaching that to the point that people get tired of hearing it. But it's both sadness, but also joy with the overcoming. It's the overcoming that has Bobby Dorm's one of the names. You know, there used to be a group of African-American folks led by Walt Tarpley, and the Jewish community led by Charles Lazarus, or Bob Lazarus, that used to meet periodically to sit and talk about the city and what had to happen and how we had to move forward. And to hear some of Walt's stories and Bob Lazarus' stories were amazing. That's the Columbus that exists here, where all communities begin to come together and have an honest conversation, not so much about race, but so much about what we want to accomplish and whether or not everybody, as we talked about before, Eric, has access to opportunities. And I think, as I think of folks that have moved forward, it's that access to opportunities that is so vitally important to the growth of this city.
Yeah, I think that was well said, Mr. Dillard. Thank you. I know these are difficult topics, but I think that's a perfect segue into another question I have for you. I think when people hear these stories, they sometimes think this was all in the past. These are all things that, I mean, in a lot of ways, African-Americans have overcome a lot, but these instances of systemic racism, they have lasting effects even today in 2020. So if you could talk a little bit about that, the lasting effects, and then also what you would like to see the next generation of folks do to help going forward to affect meaningful change.
Well, a couple of things. You see it today in a lot of different ways. Let me use the platform of, or the theme of, access and opportunity as a way of talking about that. If you look at it close, at least from my perspective, a lot of the conflict we have with police in the African-American community really has the underlying theme there really is lack of access to justice, access to have people working for you, the police department, who understand and appreciate, right, your culture. When they do that, when they have access to that kind of information, the opportunities to shoot people in the back are limited. That behavior doesn't surface. And as you think through it, that whole piece, well, let me put it this way. Access means giving to the people the opportunity and responsibility, okay, to make decisions concerning their own lives. I think where we are now is, and you're seeing this really bubble back up in the Black Lives Movement. People want to have to make decisions, about their own lives. Back in the days in the 60s, during that time, we called it maximum feasible citizen participation. It's a long word, but what that means is we get to decide how our lives go, and we participate in that process. And that's what you see in the Black Lives Movement. And what we're seeing now, I think, and both in the murders of Black folks, is the fact that they don't have the opportunity. They don't have access to the resources. You know what I mean? They don't have access to the resources to help change their lives.
Well, Mr. Dillard, that's all I need. Again, thank you so much for your time. And I hope you have a great rest of your day and a great holiday season as well.
You too.
To read the stories in our Blackout series, visit dispatch.com.